So in our passage for today, we get this one detail that we might think is just adding color to the story. When Jesus asks, "Do you have anything to eat?" Is this just a detail just for the sake of adding color and flavor? Or does it mean so much more? It could be something like, "Oh, Jesus, he's just like us." Like, you know, those tabloids in the grocery store checkout line, you know, celebrities, they're just like us. Jesus, he's just like us, wondering what's for dinner. But I think that it is teaching us something very important in this Easter moment. You probably know that the Gospel of Luke and the Acts of the Apostles were both written by the same author as a two-volume set. They are addressed to somebody named Theophilus, which can mean the one who loves God. And scholars, some of them say that Theophilus is each and every one of you in this room. You are someone who loves God, and so these two volumes are addressed to you. And what the writer is undertaking, he tells us in the very beginning of this gospel, "Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who, from the first, were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. With this in mind, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I too decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught." The author had not seen these things with his own eyes, but he had interviewed people who were there, the ones who were the eyewitnesses to these things. And this detail matters so much that out of everything that could have been recorded, that this is there about the resurrected Christ, that he comes to the disciples and has this conversation with them. Have you heard of Gnosticism? It was made famous by some of the Dan Brown novels when it sort of put out the theory that there was something of a conspiracy going on when Christianity was just starting to develop, because there were gospels that were put in caves, in urns, they were sealed up and hidden. And there were all of these texts that did not make it into what is now the official canon of Christianity. As Christianity was developing, scholars used the term proto-orthodoxy to describe what eventually became our set of beliefs that we have been handed on as Christians. And these were outside the canon. This kind of Gnosticism is an umbrella term for all of these different traditions, many of which were centered on Jesus and have some things in common with Christianity and what we believe today, but some things are very different. The Gnostic beliefs, one of the important things for them was that Jesus did not have a body. They would say he could not possibly have had a body. They were dualistic, meaning very black and white thinking. Some things were good and some things were evil. And to the Gnostics, the physical body was evil. And even all of creation was evil. And to be a religious person was to learn how to free yourself from the entrapment of your physical body and to be spirit. They believed in this so strongly that they even said that God was not the creator of this earth that we see, that it was a fallen, evil demigod who created this mess as something of a prank. Because how could a good and loving God have created this situation that we are in right now? So they said, no, Jesus, who, yes, they do worship as the one who frees us and saves us, but they did not believe that he could have been fully human and fully divine. They believed he only looked like he had a body, something like a hologram. He only seemed to be like us, but it was a trick of the eye, that really he was pure spirit. And so if we listen to this passage again, Jesus says, "It is I myself. Touch me and see, for a ghost does not have flesh and bones as you see that I have." And when he had said this, he showed them his hands and his feet. While in their joy they were disbelieving and still wondering, he said to them, "Have you anything here to eat?" And they gave him a piece of broiled fish, and he took it and ate it in their presence. This conversation that he has a body which could be felt and touched, he could breathe on them, he could eat in front of them, this is not just a throwaway detail. This is so important to these eyewitnesses to have it recorded that Jesus was not a ghost, that Jesus was incarnate, that he was embodied, that he took on flesh and bone and he ate with them. Last week we talked about practicing forbearance as an Easter experience when Jesus returns for Thomas and cuts him some holy slack. And I suggested that as you go about your week, if you have the opportunity to practice forbearance with someone else, that would be an Easter moment. And this week I want to challenge and encourage you to think about your mealtimes and see if they could also be symbols of resurrection in your own life. So you have thought about the best meal you have ever had, and for many of us, the majority of our meals do not come close to that meal. Mealtime for us has become incredibly complicated. If Jesus appeared in your kitchen at 5 p.m. and said, "Do you have anything to eat?" I think you might feel a little bit panicked, would you? Do you have anything to eat is a complicated topic, even with all of our privilege. We have so many choices. We have such an abundance. But what's for dinner is still a challenge, and I have been wondering why that is. To many people, eating and drinking has simply become an annoyance. Have you heard someone say how much more they could get done if they didn't need to stop and eat lunch or dinner? Have you heard someone fretting over things like how the food pyramid that we grew up with is now suddenly scrapped? It was wrong all along. Are you listening to all of the conflicting reports about what's actually healthy for you? If you were to invite your friends and family over to have dinner, don't you think at the table you might have someone who's vegan and someone who's vegetarian and someone who's practicing keto and someone who's practicing paleo and someone who's gluten-free? What's for dinner? It's very complicated. And even if you're just fixing a meal for yourself, we have lost so much of our cultural traditions. A lot of us don't really have a good guideline, a good rubric culturally for what we even would like to eat. Should we fix Italian? Should we prepare something Mexican? What is for dinner? And there are so many emotions tied up with what we're eating. We've placed value judgments on what it is and how we eat. What's for dinner is often something that makes us feel judged. There are values placed on bodies, morality of body size, and shaming of people because of their appearance, assumptions we make about people because of how we look. I wonder if we haven't created something of a new rubric of Gnosticism, claiming that our bodies are bad, that this is not a gift from a good creator, that we have bodies, that we get hungry, and that we need to feed ourselves. Perhaps maybe in our culture today, there's an ideal body, an ideal way to eat, but certainly not ours, and certainly not what we have to eat. This seems to me to be the state of things at the moment. But the scriptures, I think, can still recall us to a better way when we remember how important it was to those eyewitnesses that Jesus came, like us, in a human body, flesh and bone, to eat and drink, to share meals with his friends, that he gets hungry and turns to others for sustenance, and most of all, that around these tables that Jesus was teaching people how to love one another and how to care about each other. Eating has many ethical implications as well. In our scriptures, the early church is described as a place of sharing, such radical sharing, so that not just that meal, which was often potluck around the table, was shared, but that people would bring that food out to the wider community. Now, some of you, this will make you very squeamish, and some of you might delight in it. I'd be curious to take a poll at the end. Do you know that ant colonies share their food in such a radical way that they are all equally full or hungry? They practice this thing that scientists call trophallaxis, and they have what they call a social stomach. That's like an extra stomach pouch, where if there is a piece of food to be consumed, they gather what they can and they share it in their social stomach. And as they pass by one another, because they're always very busy and always running this way and that, it looks as though they're kissing. But what they're doing is sharing that food. They share it so completely that any ant in the entire colony would be equally full or equally hungry. So the workers always know when it's time to go find more food. There is such radical sharing among them. And the early church was designed to be this one body. All of those scriptures that tell us you are one body. We're going to share this one loaf of bread at communion and this one cup. And we're going to go out and make sure that all are fed around us. This is the good news, that we aren't like the rest of the world, where some have so much and some have so little. Imagine if everyone in this room was equally full and as equally satisfied as everyone around us. The message of the early church was that we needed to be aware of the hunger of each other. It's hard to separate our own disordered relationships with food from the fact that there are hungry children all over the world. The grace that my father used to say at the dinner table every night included the line, "Keep us ever mindful of the needs of others." What if we allowed our own hunger to remind us of our unity with everyone around us? And what if one of the things that's missing from our ideal meal is that call to share what we have? So how could we make changes in our daily lives that would honor the sanctity of the fact that we have bodies, acknowledge that our bodies are good, and that our bodies can remind us how we are connected to one another? I wonder if you could make recurring donations to Operation Hope or frequent visits to Nourish Bridgeport, if when you have leftovers, you could bring them to Fridgeport. Even something as simple as hanging a bird feeder outside to remind you, if you were to hang it outside your kitchen window, to remind you of the hunger all throughout creation. We have become Gnostic to a certain degree. We are dualistic, that something is wrong with our bodies, but I am so glad that the ancient church fathers and mothers recorded this as our Christianity instead, that our bodies are good, that Christ came to be enfleshed, that Christ came to show us what it means to gather around tables and be fed, and that this Easter resurrection experience comes with this simple and amazing question: do you have anything to eat? This is the truth. You were made in the image of a loving creator. Your ensouled body is good. You deserve to be nourished, and you are capable of nourishing those around you as well. Friends, may we be ever mindful of the needs of others. May all be fed, may all be healed, and may all be loved.